This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The Spurs have kicked the Suns until they're down 2-0. Joe Johnson may come back. For Phoenix, he could be the one who might reverse the series that they're losing 2-0. Meanwhile, Detroit-Miami stands at 1 game each until they play again and go at one another long and hard. Let's get a preview now of games to come from Le Batard. The Le Batard to whom I refer is Dan, who covers the big guys and the biggest guy for the Miami Herald. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
Does the fact that Miami heads to Detroit for games 3 and 4 of the Eastern Conference Finals with a series tied 1-1 constitute a moral victory for Detroit at this point?
That's what they say, but I don't believe at this stage in the season that you focus on home court advantage because the teams are too good at this latest stage. Any one of these teams is talented enough to win on the road. Detroit lost earlier in the playoffs at home to a team far weaker than Miami and Indiana. So, home court is supposed to give you an advantage, and Detroit has it for the moment, but they have it right up until they don't have it, which is when Miami takes it away from them.
Many observers feel that the series hinges on Shaquille O'Neal's ability to play through his injuries. Does that point of view fail to consider the abilities of O'Neal's teammates, or for that matter, the abilities of the defending NBA champs?
People keep pointing to that, but Miami just beat Detroit with Shaquille O'Neal being limited. Shaquille O'Neal limited remains the best center in the league. He's still, even at 75%, more dominant than anyone else. I would say to you that the key to this series is Dwayne Wade, O'Neal's teammate. Dwayne Wade had a bad game in Game 1, Miami lost. Dwayne Wade had a good game in Game 2, Miami won. It's an oversimplification, but if you're looking for one spot to point a finger, that's where I would put it, because Shaquille O'Neal is going to give you, even in this condition, Shaquille O'Neal is going to give you 17, 18 points and 8 rebounds.
O'Neal was recently sworn in as a U.S. Deputy Marshal. Are you aware of any criticism he's received as a result of the perception that his second career is detracting from what is allegedly still his first?
Well, he wanted it to be undercover work, which was going to be a little bit difficult. But it hasn't gotten in the way. It hasn't gotten in the way quite yet.
In the West, it seemed that Steve Nash and the Phoenix Suns were too strong offensively for any team to prevent them from reaching the finals. How has San Antonio managed to win games 1 and 2?
Well, that's the style of play that tends to win this time of year. People inside the NBA point to Detroit and San Antonio and expect to see those two teams in the finals because it's a bloodier game, closer to the rim, and there's never nearly as much scoring in the playoffs as there is in the regular season. San Antonio does not let you play the kind of game you want to play. They impose their will upon you, and you have to beat them at their game, which is a game that's played more in the quicksand than it is on the trapeze.
Well, should the Suns fail to make the finals, the notion that offensive-minded, fast-breaking teams are the NBA's wave of the future may have to be reconsidered. Would that be a bad thing for the league?
It's a bad thing for the viewer. We want it to be the wave of the future because it's a vastly more entertaining style of play. We don't want to see San Antonio and Detroit in the finals. Nobody outside of San Antonio and Detroit wants to see that as a finals because it's a quicksand quagmire. Mm-hmm. It's not fun to watch. What's fun to watch is Phoenix against anybody because it's an aerial display. And, defense isn't something that's terribly sexy. Defense is the housewife who stays home and takes care of the kids and tells you to take out the trash. Offense is Catherine Zeta-Jones.
The NBA and its players' union have failed to agree on a new contract. Commissioner Stern says the two sides will meet soon. What's your best guess as to what will happen with a new collective bargaining agreement?
They will not lose games. They will not go the route of hockey. They will not go the route of baseball. The last time that David Stern put his will upon the union caved, and if it comes to that point, it'll happen again because these guys don't want to lose salaries. The thing that happened last time that there was an NBA lockout was, you had a lot of players being quoted as like, yeah, I have 9 cars, but that's a lot of insurance payments. Or, Patrick Ewing saying, yeah, sure, we make a lot of money, but we spend a lot of money too. The NBA, the league doesn't need that anymore.
I guess expenses were higher in 1998.
They're even higher now. If you've seen the cars that these guys are driving these days, they're not just cars. They're entertainment systems, and also there's the a rumor going around, we haven't been able to place it yet, that one NBA player has an automobile with a live shark tank in it. We're still trying to figure out who that is. We think it's Gilbert Arenas of Washington, but yeah, there's not going to be a lot of sympathy for people who spend that way.
You'll call me as soon as you've confirmed this.
Oh, I've been chasing it. It's a story I've been chasing for the better part of a year and a half.
All right, enough talk about various other matters. What, in your opinion, would be the better finals matchup, Detroit, San Antonio, or Miami, Phoenix?
A live shark, Bill. A live shark in his car. He's got a live shark in a fish tank in his car, in a shark tank.
Enough about the shark. We got to get serious now. Which matchup are we more likely to see in the finals?
I think the viewer would prefer Miami and Phoenix. I think what the viewer is going to end up seeing is Miami-San Antonio, and then San Antonio is going to win that. I don't think anybody's going to beat them this year, unless Tim Duncan gets hurt.
Spoken like a man who's not going to be popular in Miami.
Yeah, thanks a lot for doing that to me.
And there's no Sharks in San Antonio.
No, although Rasheed Wallace plays for Detroit, and he fancies himself one of those. So if they get to the finals, he has said that the red zone, the sea of red at Miami games, that's blood, and he's the shark. So let's keep it up with the shark talk.
Dan Le Batard is a columnist for the Miami Herald. The Heat is his beat, among other sports treats. Dan, thanks again.
Thank you.
Phoenix Suns forward Paul Shirley averaged a heady 1.3 points and 2/10 of a rebound in 9 regular season games this year. He has yet to unglue himself from the bench in the 2005 playoffs, yet the Suns' 12th man still manages to lead the league in blogs. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Steve Goldstein reports.
Here's an example of a typical NBA blog entry. It's by Bruce Bowen of the San Antonio Spurs. When it comes to the end of the regular season, you have to take care of the business at hand. When you start trying to plan 2 or 3 weeks ahead of time, that's when things go south. Bowen managed to get 2 cliches into 2 sentences. Paul Shirley's approach to his blog, or journal entry as he prefers, is much different.
Most of my colleagues are quite tall. I am no exception at 6'10". When in captivity on the basketball court, I am easily able to forget the fact that my bones are stretched to an extraordinary length because I am surrounded by other members of the freak show. Not so when I am released into the wild. Then I am forced to remember by stupid people.
Since this season's playoffs began, Shirley has waxed profound on the excessive number of television channels, censorship in Russia, and even his role for the Phoenix Suns as the guy who never plays. Shirley, who excelled as a college forward at Iowa State University, says it was difficult adapting to that latest role.
But then again, I might have the best job in the world because I'm not expected. There's no pressure on me, yet I get paid a pretty substantial salary to do what I do.
In one journal entry, Shirley admitted a distaste for the media attention he's received. After all, he's supposed to be a basketball player, not a writer, and he's given that deep thought, something we're not supposed to expect from professional athletes.
I don't know that it says a lot about our society that when someone writes something that's relatively straightforward and what I would consider average writing, that it is made into a big deal. In some ways, it's a little depressing because I think everyone should be speaking their mind and saying what they believe instead of just clinging to these cliches and things that have been said so many times.
Shirley's son's teammates don't read the journal entries, but head coach Mike D'Antoni, who hasn't played Shirley even 1 minute in the playoffs, says he's a good player, teammate, and writer. D'Antoni says he wouldn't miss Shirley's musings.
Oh, yeah, I've got to check it out because I can cut him, and he knows that. So he has to be careful with me.
In fact, Shirley was cut by D'Antoni on the eve of the Suns' opening game. He rejoined the team after 2 months playing for a Russian team that didn't have enough money to pay him. His journal entries began in March when he wrote about an 8-day road trip. Keeping a journal wasn't new for Shirley, who also played in Greece. But with his NBA blog, the 27-year-old Shirley's opinions aren't only being read by loved ones. In some cases, he says, that's humbling.
I do think that people relate to it because our generation doesn't necessarily have a voice, and I'm certainly not putting myself up to be that voice. But in many cases, whether it's in politics or current events, we are forgotten as far as the way we approach things.
In other cases, it leads to controversy and overreaction. One ESPN commentator said that Shirley should be kicked out of the league for wondering whether scientists were confused about how fast HIV progresses because of how big Magic Johnson has gotten.
I mean, if you saw Magic Johnson, you'd think, good Lord, he's huge. And, you know, I'm happy that he's still alive because it's amazing that he is, because he has had HIV for 15 years or whatever. So him having HIV doesn't make him immune from us talking about it, or it doesn't make him a saint and we can't, you know, maybe take a little jab at him now and then.
There's no telling how long Paul Shirley will last in the NBA. 12th men don't enjoy much job security, but he says it's been a lucky ride so far.
I've told people all along that this is a way for me to delay adulthood because I'm not expected to do anything remotely responsible right now. So this gives me some time to decide what I'm going to do.
His next step may be to write a book. Publishers have expressed interest, but Shirley says no contracts have been signed. Besides, he says he'd be shocked if anyone would want to read something he's written. Of course, he said the same thing about those little journal entries. For Only a Game, I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix.
Hey, man, you should have played basketball. You're really tall. What? Basketball? You're kidding. Why didn't I think of this sooner? It's a good thing you came along, man. He continued, just how tall are you? I replied with my correct height, which was quite the Herculean effort, considering the retorts that occurred to me. Back to his original line of questioning, he asked.
On Thursday, in Caracas, Venezuela, Chico Carrasquel died of cardiac arrest. He was 77. The distinction mentioned at the top of his obituary was that Carrasquel had been the first Latino player to make the roster of a Major League All-Star game. He started for the American League in 1951 and singled off Robin Roberts in his first at-bat. But Alfonso Chico Carrasquel's more significant contribution was helping to show the next much larger generation of Latino players his love for the game that made him a hero throughout Venezuela. Luis Aparicio called Carrasquel my hero and mentor. Ozzy Guillen celebrated him as a great friend, person, and role model. For years after he'd made a name for himself with the White Sox, Indians, and Athletics, Chico Carrasquel continued playing winter ball in Venezuela, in part because he felt it was his responsibility to do so. Into his 60s, he attended games regularly, signed autographs tirelessly, and welcomed into his home anybody who wanted to see his collection of jerseys and inscribed baseballs. He was a nimble, sure-handed infielder with a lifetime batting average of .258, but for Latin Americans in general, and Venezuelans in particular, he was a baseball man whose significance only began with his statistics. Following Chico Carrasquel's death, Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, announced 2 days of national mourning, and then he shouted, Viva Carrasquel. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, from the stringed racket to making a racket with strings. But first, tomorrow in Indianapolis, a score and more of gentlemen and one lady will start their engines. Then each of them will try to drive 500 miles more quickly than anybody else on the track can do it. The woman in the ensuing 200-mile-an-hour constantly shifting traffic jam will be Danica Patrick, who qualified fourth. She will be following in the tire tracks of Janet Guthrie, the first woman ever to drive in the Indy 500 in 1977. Janet Guthrie is the author of a recent book about her experiences entitled Janet Guthrie, A Life at Full Throttle, and she joins me now from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis. Janet Guthrie, welcome to Only a Game.
Terrific to be with you, Bill.
I hadn't realized until I read your book that you could tear a car apart and put it together again, as well as drive it very fast. When did your interest in engines declare itself?
Well, my interest in engines declared itself when I discovered that I needed a new engine to get to the next sports car race, and I didn't have the money to pay a mechanic. Therefore, I learned.
Even after you had demonstrated your skills and earned a ride at Indy, some of the other drivers were skeptical. Billy Vukovich, for example, claimed at one point that if you still had the strength to steer your car after 40 laps, he would eat his hat. Is it true that a little later on he went looking for somebody who could make him a chocolate hat?
So he said. Billy said that before he had ever seen me drive anything, and I drove my first IndyCar race at Trenton at the beginning of May 1976. Billy was in that race, and I believe he discovered that I was what I said I was, a racing driver who just happened to be a woman.
You faced abuse not only from fellow drivers, but from spectators as well. This year's pre-race coverage has been absent that kind of talk as far as Danica Patrick is concerned. Do you suppose she will face abuse once the race begins?
No, none whatsoever. I think most of that has been dealt with, although not all of it. There are a few little naysayers out there here and there. But Danica is the first woman ever to come here with top-notch equipment and the full backing of a winning team. Ray Hall Letterman, of course, are the defending champions at Indianapolis. Buddy Rice won last year. I think Danica Patrick stands a good chance of running up front for the entire race and a better chance than most drivers in the field of winning it.
NASCAR has captured the attention of sports fans in this country to an extent that few would have thought possible just a couple of decades ago. Why hasn't open-wheel racing fared as well as NASCAR in the U.S.?
I'm afraid that some of it has to do with the struggle between the sanctioning bodies, CART and the Indy Racing League. I thought the Indy Racing League had the right idea, American drivers, oval tracks, and a format that attempted to reduce the expenses as much as possible. The opposing sanctioning body was a very expensive situation to get into. Of course, it's always expensive at these levels of the sport. In any case, NASCAR has become the most heavily attended series in the country, and I hope that IndyCar racing, which is tremendously competitive and very exciting, will regain its former luster.
It's interesting that you ended that answer with a reference back to IndyCar racing, because you had some versatility. I mean, you seemed to me from reading your book, you were willing to get behind the wheel of anything that moved fast. You didn't worry too much what kind of car it was.
That's true, particularly at the top levels of the sport. There were certainly some adventures there. I did enjoy Winston Cup racing. It's Nextel Cup now, of course, but it was just flat-out fun. The slingshot pass where you run up in somebody's draft and pull out from behind them at the very last moment and go on around to pass them, that's the most fun I know of in motorsport.
In your biography, at one point you refer to the challenge Bobby Riggs offered. He wanted to race you just as he wanted to play tennis against Billie Jean King. And, of course, you didn't dignify that challenge. But what do you suppose Riggs would have done if you'd said, "Okay, bub, get yourself a car and meet me at the starting line"?
Oh, dear. Oh, dear. That was news to me at a press conference before I drove my first IndyCar race at Trenton, New Jersey in early May of 1976. Somebody asked me that question. I hadn't even heard about it. I thought it was just silly. Bobby Riggs trying to get attention again.
Late in the book, you present an entry from the journal that you were keeping 25 years ago. Would you read a little portion of that for us?
Gladly. This actually is looking forward from the ending of the book, which is the end of the race in the Indianapolis 500 in 1978. The paragraph goes, "Altogether, I drove so few IndyCar races, only 11 spread over 4 years, that I had little time to relish the fullest passionate enjoyment of those incredible machines. In 1980, when I was turning some of the fastest corner times of anyone at the Speedway, I wrote in my journal of warming the car, at last, stand on the gas, all is prepared, the engine unleashed, the great machine leaps forward, springs from a crawl into full flight, and the song begins. The power rushes to respond, and I have it in my hands. It was a pleasure that came with experience, and it saturated my soul."
That is some exceptionally lyrical writing about a very noisy, very dirty sport. What you were describing, I assume, is the joy that kept you in racing.
That's absolutely right. There is nothing for euphoria like the knowledge that you have just driven a really good race against top competition and beaten a worthy competitor. The grass is greener, the sky is bluer, everything smells better, tastes better when you've driven a race like that.
In the epilogue of your book, you write that, quote, "Some things have changed for women in auto racing, some things haven't." To what extent has NASCAR's diversity program succeeded in bringing more women into at least that part of the racing world?
NASCAR's diversity program is still operating at the very lowest level of the sport, the local series, so it remains to be seen whether this will actually succeed in bringing drivers along to the upper levels of the sport or not. It's an enormously expensive game. They seem to be paying lip service and giving drivers a little bit of a chance down at the bottom. We'll see whether it bears fruit or not. And that's not just women, of course, but also blacks.
You've mentioned that you think Danica Patrick has as good a chance as anybody to win this year's Indy 500 and certainly as good a car as anybody else in the race. So I assume, is it safe to assume you'll be rooting for her?
Oh, absolutely. I think it would be a great benefit to IndyCar racing if she were to win the race. Of course, she'd be on the cover of every magazine in the world. She would instantly become the most famous woman in sport. But it would draw attention to the close competition that the Indy Racing League offers at Indianapolis as well as in their other venues.
Are you surprised, though, that these several decades after you drove at Indy, only you and three other women have participated in the race?
To be honest, I thought it might be two generations before a woman got a real chance at the top levels of the sport, because opportunities for women do seem to come in two-generation waves. So in a way, this is one generation sooner than I expected that a woman comes here with a real chance of winning due to the team she's with, the equipment she has, and her own talent and determination.
Janet Guthrie, the first woman to drive at the Indianapolis 500, is the author of Janet Guthrie, A Life at Full Throttle, published by Sport Classic Books. She joined me from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis. Janet, thank you very much for speaking with me.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Andre Agassi was shown the door at Roland Garros on Tuesday. Andy Roddick and James Blake were bounced on Thursday. No American men remain at the French Open, unless you include a 33-year-old coach named Raj Chaudhary. As Robert Rand reports, the Californian is already looking forward to the day when he'll trade his tennis racket for a career in the music racket.
When Raj Chaudhary is on the tennis court, he hears the staccato of racket-hitting ball differently.
There's two things that I'm pretty passionate about, and I love the sport of tennis, and I love playing the guitar, I love music.
Raj Chaudhary travels the women's tour. He coaches an American named Jill Krabus, but he also brings along a collapsible instrument that works like a Walkman with strings.
Being on the road, you have a lot of sort of time where it's kind of downtime. You're waiting around. You never know when your player's going to play. And playing the guitar for me, even if I'm sitting in the middle of the player's lounge, I have my travel guitar with me, and I can plug in my headphones, and I can kind of be in my own space in the midst of a pretty competitive world. All right, Jill, try and stay up on that baseline. Take the ball a little bit earlier. That's it.
Raj Chaudhary didn't always want to be a coach.
When I was playing college tennis, I had aspirations of playing pro tennis, and I actually, in my last college match, tore my anterior cruciate ligament in my knee.
The injury kept Raj Chaudhary off the court for nearly a year.
So at that point in time, I started to play the guitar, and that kind of saved my sanity a little bit.
Chaudhary entered a music conservatory and studied classical guitar. Eventually, he shifted to the work of contemporary artists, acoustic finger pickers like Michael Hedges, whose composition Ragamuffin Chaudhary is playing here. Chaudhary returned to the tennis courts, but was unhappy as a competitor. He decided to coach and to devote more time to music.
I think one of the things that keeps me healthy as a coach is to play the guitar, because it puts me in a learning position.
Lessons learned on the guitar, Chaudhary says, can translate to the tennis court. He tells one story about struggling, really struggling, to master one especially difficult guitar composition.
And for 2 weeks, I had zero progress, just zero. It didn't put a dent in it. And after 2 weeks, I woke up one morning, and suddenly, I could do it. And I use that with my players a lot in the sense that, like, there's a lot of times when we'll be working on something where it will seem like nothing is actually happening. But if you kind of stay the course for a little while, oftentimes that breakthrough will occur.
Jill Krabus is the player Raj Chaudhary coaches. She says playing guitar has made him a better on-court teacher.
Sometimes when he's playing, he feels that he plays better when his hand and his arms are more relaxed when he's strumming the strings. And he incorporates that a little bit with my tennis because he feels like he plays better when he's calmer and more at peace. And I'm similar on the court where I'm a little bit stronger and I play better when I'm calmer and more relaxed and keep my face and hands and body more relaxed.
At the French Open, there's a special room in one of the players' lounges at Roland Garros. It's filled with guitars. A lot of players go there to try their hand on the strings, to listen to the handful of athletes who actually play. Raj Chaudhary says some of the stars, past and present, have played: John McEnroe, Jim Courier, Gustavo Kuerten. As for the future, Chaudhary says a time will come when he'll grow tired of traveling on the professional women's tour.
I love coaching. It is a true passion of mine, but that will come to an end at some point. I'm sure I'll stay involved with tennis in some way, but I would like eventually to sort of shift over to where music is the primary focus and really pursue being very creative and performing a lot in the future.
Raj Chaudhary, tennis coach and prospectively full-time musician. For Only a Game, I'm Robert Rand, reporting from the WTA Tour.
You're listening to Only a Game. The Scripps Howard National Spelling Bee takes place Wednesday and Thursday in Washington, D.C. Commentator Tim O'Shea looks forward to the day when his kids will take part in that competition. Oh, wait, no he doesn't.
There are many things I hope my kids will do with their lives, and I'm not picky. Astronaut would be good. Lion tamer sounds exciting. High school graduate, spokesmodel, or maybe place kicker for an arena football team would pass muster. But I pray my kids never aspire to be champion spellers. After watching the National Spelling Bee on TV last year, I vowed to do my best to ensure my children never make the trip. I don't have anything against good spelling, but the National Spelling Bee is to good spelling what the Indy 500 is to good driving. It looks like driving, it sounds like driving, but normal driving doesn't require helmets, pit crews, or fences to contain flying shards of flaming auto parts. And the National Spelling Bee is not normal spelling. For 15 rounds, well-groomed, pint-sized spell-it-alls slug it out over words like hypozeuxis and nathonic as their parents and spelling coaches fret, squeal, and videotape the event for posterity. My 10-year-old is learning how to spell frolic, picnic, and donkey, while those kids are nailing words like boudin, symphily, and dipnuous. Inviting a donkey to frolic at a picnic sounds like fun. Inviting a friend with a case of symphily in his dipnuous to share his boudin in your backyard is not my idea of a good time. I'll admit part of this bias is the fact I'm nursing a 20-year-old spelling grudge. As a 16-year-old, I won my high school's junior class spelling bee, crushing my competition en route to the finals, which were to be beamed via closed-circuit TV to the 2,000 students across the entire school. I spent days preparing. When the finals began, I was pumped. So pumped that on my first word of the contest, I froze, panicked, and fell apart, misspelling the word belfry with two L's. There was an eruption of laughter, and I quickly snaked off camera, back to homeroom, defeated, deflated, and ashamed. My chance for victory got stuck in a misspelled belfry, and I never made much of an effort to be the best speller after that, fully embracing the power and grace of a reliable spell-checking program. So I'd rather let my kids succeed or fail in other things. Telling a group of people you'd been cut from an arena football team sounds so much cooler than explaining, if it wasn't for the confusion over the origin of the prefix, I had erythemia in the bag. But if they do make the decision to go the route of the champion speller, I'll wish them my best, but won't be making the trip to Washington. My picnic schedule's filling up, and someone's got to frolic with the donkey. I put a spell on you.
Tim O'Shea is a freelance writer who lives and writes in Concord, New Hampshire. That's N-U-H-A-M-S-T-E-R. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at Cabot Cheese.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, fisticuffs and fishnets at the skating rink. But first, I'm joined by our analyst, Charlie Pierce, for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
A provocative tease, as we say in the radio game.
The best teases. The Phoenix Suns trail the San Antonio Spurs 2-0 in the NBA's Western Conference Finals. What happened to the Suns' vaunted offense?
All right, you're going to save this tape on me, I know, but does the phrase "done like dinner" mean anything to you? The problem with the Phoenix Suns' vaunted offense is not that it's disappeared. It's that it's been outscored by the San Antonio Spurs, who are playing their most consistently good offense of the year.
One conclusion to be made following Game 2 of the Eastern Conference Finals, in which the Pistons and Heat are tied at one game apiece, is that Dwayne Wade is really good at basketball.
We are very happy to see this, as you know. It was a signifying game, the second game, for him because he had played so badly in the first game. And there were a couple of little adjustments that were made. And when they needed him to win the game for them, because Shaquille O'Neal is pretty plainly at 40 or 50%, he scored 20 points in the fourth quarter, which is exactly what people like Michael Jordan used to do. I still don't think they're going to win the series. But it was certainly, if he isn't reckoned to be, at worst, the second-best young player in the league now, I don't know what he would have to do.
NBA Commissioner David Stern announced this week that collective bargaining will resume shortly. One sticking point has been the commissioner's desire to halt the drafting of teenagers into the league. Will the union go along with that eventually?
I think, you know, the union has sold out its younger and future members before and will likely do it again. I just don't see a plan they can come up with which will stand up the first time an 18-year-old has Nike hire a lawyer for him.
Barry Bonds was tested for performance-enhancing drugs on Wednesday, along with several of his Giants teammates. Which TV network gets the rights to the announcement of those results?
I'm utterly amazed that this wasn't on live television at this point. I don't know that you'll get the results unless there is an unfortunate leak of the data, because I still don't think you're going to see Barry Bonds playing baseball this season.
This week, the House Government Reform Committee approved the so-called Clean Sports Act of 2005, which would, among other things, vastly enlarge the responsibility and power of the United States Anti-Doping Agency to police American pro sports. Does this legislation stand any chance at all of passing? Please tell me no.
Oh, I think there's no question. I mean, those of us who lived through the cocaine drug craziness of the 80s, this is a way to look tough without actually doing anything, although I really am amazed that the modern conservative politician who doesn't believe the government can do anything right and wants everything devolved to either the states or to big business thinks the one thing they can do is run an army and check urine.
The next question has to be, will plank number one in Senator McCain's presidential campaign platform be, quote, "I cleaned up sports"?
No, that'll be plank 1A. Plank 1 will be the judicial compromise. This will certainly be second. And as much as I have great affection for Senator McCain, I've come to like him more than I admire him for the first time.
Speaking of politicians and sports, former Secretary of State Colin Powell is apparently interested in purchasing the Washington Nationals. Would you care to predict how Powell will fare in Operation Hardball Storm?
Well, I think he's been brought in to be pretty much the closer among this particular investment groups. There are nine groups bidding to buy the Nationals from Major League Baseball. Colin Powell represents an enormous amount of credibility in Washington. Editorial comment, Lord knows why, after that speech at the UN, but neither here nor there. He will be the deciding factor, I think, and I think he'll wind up owning a baseball team.
On Tuesday, the WNBA welcomed its first black female owner. What, if anything, will Sheila Johnson's role as owner of the Washington Mystics change?
Probably not much. She does come from an interesting background. She was married to Robert Johnson, who owns the Charlotte Bobcats and founded Black Entertainment Television with her. They divorced 3 years ago. She does come with an interesting credential, though. She's the director of the Washington International Horse Show, which is held annually at the MCI Center.
If you can put them in the seats for one thing, you can put them in the seats for another.
You're exactly right.
There will apparently be transparency in BCS balloting starting next season. Boy, tear up the show. Can you help us understand why this change came to be and what may happen as a result?
Well, you can pass the popcorn because you're going to see 300 egomaniacs tearing each other's guts out every year now.
They're being coaches.
Yes, the football coaches will now find out who voted for whom in the final regular season coaches poll. There's been a lot of call for this. People don't understand how certain decisions get made. But the best thing is going to be watching football coaches in high dudgeon because there's nothing more amusing.
Charlie, one of my favorite all-time sports writers has been honored this week by a brewery. I look forward to sampling Flying Dog Brewery's Gonzo Imperial Porter as soon as it's available. How about you?
Yes, it's a tribute, of course, to Hunter S. Thompson, who's the first piece I ever read by Hunter S. Thompson. It was a piece called Fear and Loathing at the Kentucky Derby, which I believe he wrote for Scanlon's Monthly years ago. It's sort of an odd way to pay tribute, but fairly well in keeping.
Thompson, of course, is near and dear to my heart because he set the precedent for writing about the Super Bowl without actually ever going to the game.
Well, apparently he wrote about the Foreman-Ali fight without ever getting out of the swimming pool at the hotel.
Finally, Charlie, El Hadji Diouf, who plays soccer for Bolton Wanderers and makes about $73,000 a week, has requested a public defender for a case that involves spitting at a fan. And Her Majesty's representatives can't be amused by this.
The guy makes $73,000 a week, and they gave him legal aid because he's being charged for spitting at an 11-year-old. Charles Barkley at least paid his own fine.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and edifies you, dear listener, pro bono each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Earlier this month, an otherwise respectable public skating rink in downtown Providence, Rhode Island, was commandeered by a group of athletes bedecked in lipstick and exotic hosiery. These rogue skaters endure speed, chaos, and the odd fistfight. As Only a Game's Karen Given recently discovered, this scenario has been playing out at roller derby venues from Seattle to Orlando and almost everywhere in between.
Ivana Klauber is poised, rough and tumble. She's wearing green. Look at that. And fishnets that are totally ripped. And I thought that the rip was a bruise, but actually it's not. And
it's less than a week before Providence Roller Derby's first exhibition bout, and a rather petite skater named Rhoda Perdition is describing her more imposing teammate, Ivana Klauber. Like most of the roller girls here, Rhoda pauses often to giggle and says she joined roller derby for the fun. Ivana Klauber is here for other reasons.
Kicking ass, knocking all the other girls down until they cry, starting fights, and yelling.
Ivana and her teammates don't have a lot in common with the roller derby queens of the 1970s. For one, spandex and disco are out. Fishnets and tattoos are in. And while many fans might remember spending Saturday mornings watching roller derby on TV, Sarah Doom, founder and coordinator of Providence Roller Derby, says these athletes don't.
Most of us are kind of Generation Y. I'm sort of on the cusp of X and Y. But, you know, our parents have seen it and our maybe older siblings, but
there are still a few kinks to work out as the teams and crews start their second-to-last practice before the big bout. Nobody brought a watch with a second hand, so the jams are being timed by cell phone. As performed by Doom and her teammates, roller derby is a jumble of pushing and shoving, banged knees and elbows, with very little actual skating. Hard-hearted Hannah has accented her roller derby outfit with generous amounts of pink. Pink streaks in her hair, pink skate laces, pink underpants over black tights, and a very safe-looking sparkly pink helmet.
My mom's a little worried about my face, but it's really cool to be able to talk to my dad and my brother about a sport finally because they're really athletic, and now I can be like, yeah, well, I did push-ups today too.
ask Hannah and her teammates what they like about roller derby, and they practically fall over each other trying to describe it.
When I put my skates on, it's just like me more intensified and more excited about life. Just like a better person and a happier person and like more aggressive and more obnoxious and more of a brat.
Well, you're just going fast and you can smash into people and
and you're rewarded for it.
Yeah, you're rewarded for it.
You're being a jerk. All the things that aren't okay in everyday life, like being rude, being skanky, being aggressive, all the things that are like, especially for girls, that you're not supposed to do.
I know. She can
help. Today's roller derby craze was born in Austin, Texas in 1991. The final game of the first season was attended by more than 1,000 fans and a feature-length documentary film crew. That movie, called Hell on Wheels, is due out in winter of 2006. Now, between Austin's two roller derby leagues, fans can experience live bouts almost every Sunday night from April through July. Lone Star roller girl Nadia Kane, a.k.a. Smarty Pants, says after Texas, leagues sprung up in Arizona and L.A.
And then, like, suddenly it was like Seattle, Portland, Chicago, and New York, and now Atlanta, and it's everywhere. Like, at first we would find out about leagues and we'd get so excited and try to keep track of them, but we no longer try to keep track of them because it's impossible. They're everywhere.
Leagues are everywhere, and skaters are every kind of woman. The Lone Star Roller Girls include a neonatal nurse, a couple of accountants, many mothers, and a few business owners. The youngest recruit is 20. The oldest skater is 48. Roller derby has been written up in publications from the New York Times to Playboy magazine, and its notoriety comes in no small part from the sport's inherent sex appeal. Most roller girls like to fuss with their makeup and hair. They all wear short skirts. Audience members are, at times, invited to spank the skaters, and catfights are practically mandatory. But Kane says audiences shouldn't be fooled by roller derby's sexy antics.
A lot of people want to label us and say that what we're doing goes against the feminist movement or we're exploiting ourselves. But actually, we're not. We're working for ourselves, and we're promoting a very female-based community and supporting each other. And it's quite beautiful, honestly.
Back on the concrete rink at the Bank of America Skating Center in Providence, head referee Billy the Kid isn't thinking about beauty and grace. He's thinking about what tricks these women might try during their first bout.
Illegal blocking is anything basically outside of the strike zone, you know, high sticking basically. There's no pushing other teammates, tripping, pulling people down when they've already fallen, and good old-fashioned brawling.
Billy the Kid, whose spiked hair, piercings, and tattoos belie his youth as a figure skater and Eagle Scout, will be joined by referees Busta Patella and the Bishop. If women are caught doing any of the aforementioned naughties, they'll be sent to the penalty box, a.k.a. the dirty, busted-up toilet that looks like it's straight from the salvage yard.
It's just, you know, kind of embarrassing to be sitting on a toilet, so.
With all her bubbly enthusiasm, it's hard to imagine Tammy Guns will ever be sent to the penalty potty, but she admits the system isn't prepared for the very likely possibility that two skaters will be penalized at the same time.
I guess it basically depends what the ref can catch, and there are warnings, so hopefully we won't need two girls out at once, but if we do, we'll figure something out.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the inaugural bout of the Providence Roller Derby League!
There's trouble even before the start of the first jam. Team captain Sarah Doom and Switchblade Sally start a brawl. Order is quickly restored, only to disintegrate again as Doom and Switchblade take their turns as team jammers.
This is the bitter rivalry. You might see blood spill between these two. Ooh, I think that Sarah Doom tried to pull her shorts out a little bit. That didn't look very legal.
Before long, both women are assigned penalties, which they serve with Switchblade Sally sitting on Sarah Doom's lap. The women insist the fights are not staged, but they're not terribly authentic either. It's this combination of sport and performance that skaters like hard-hearted Hannah find so exciting.
couple weeks ago in practice, I knocked someone down and I fell with her, and then she started a brawl because she just didn't feel like getting up. So we're really trying to learn the sport and play the game, but taking advantage of moments to make it entertaining as well.
Many of the Providence roller girls attend a local art college, and their parents have come to town to watch them perform. The roller moms have similar reactions as they watch their daughters tumble and fall on the hard concrete rink.
Oh my God, please wear a mouth guard. Your braces were so expensive.
I thought, wow, all that money for Risney tuition, and now she's a roller derby queen.
I won't say don't do it. I told her I'd bring my rosary beads.
So did you?
They might be in my pocket. There are a lot of other things that they could be doing, so at least it's good, clean fun. It might be rough and tumble, but it's good and clean.
Jay Gilbert is coming. Oh, tumble, I got it.
The announcers keep the crowd laughing. The timekeeper remembers to start and stop his watch. An Asian gentleman in a shiny dress manages to keep the scorecards from blowing away in the wind. And as the bout continues, the women shake off the spring chill and their jitters to find their stride. As the Brown University marching band offers spirited accompaniment to the final moments of the bout, the women of the Providence Roller Derby take one last opportunity for an out-and-out brawl.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen!
League founder Sarah Doom laughs hysterically as she pummels and gets pummeled. Tammy Guns earns a penalty or two, giggling the whole time. And even Ivana Klauber looks like she's here just for the fun of it. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Providence, Rhode Island.
On wheels, the people say she's crazy as she blasts her way around the floor. While that ring ain't no one fading, she's rough, she's ready, she's about to go to war. Roaming round in vicious circles, almost plunging into jars. Last night she ruled the roller discos, but in this uniform she is above your laws. Roller dirty, roller girl, won't you roll into my world? You've been fighting all day long, wreaking havoc on the run.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. Thanks this week to Cedric Freeman and Harold Wilson at WFYI in Indianapolis. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll-free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to bump and grind with the Roller Girls of Providence, browse Only a Game show archive, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Rhoda Perdition, who discusses the origins of her Roller Girl pseudonym.
At first I wanted to be Kelly Green, because I'm Irish, but then they were like, that's not fierce enough. And I was like, what about Erin Gobralis? And they were like, that's just slutty.
Till now, I'd always thought boxing had the best nicknames. Live and loin. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.